Session number 8286, Reel 1.
Colonel Leach, Reel 1. You mentioned that when you got to India, you had to train hard in your new life. Presumably this was a reference to conversion from 18-pounders to pack artillery. What sort of new ideas did you have to absorb in order to make yourself competent in handling pack artillery?
We had to start completely from scratch. The whole scene was different. It was strange. We had to deal with Indian soldiers. One was new to India, new to mules. One had had experience of horses and a horse-drawn field regiment. But the mule, to me, when I arrived in India, was a very strange animal. I arrived at Quetta in November 1938, was met at Karachi by a bearer who was sent down, travelled up through the Bolan Pass by train, was met by my battery captain, Dick Keenlyside, who took me to his bungalow and gave me breakfast, and then I was taken to the mess and deposited there and left to my own devices. It was a weekend and everybody was away shooting. There was only one duty officer in mess, and I felt completely lost. On the Monday, I was taken up to the regimental lines. The system of mountain artillery was explained to me, and I was given an Indian officer to look after me, a Viceroy's commissioned officer to look after me, supervised by a subaltern in another battery, because all my own subalterns were away, and life started. Mountain artillery was a much sought after occupation in those days. It was the nearest we could get to active service and active service conditions. But the station, the 20th Mountain Regiment, which was stationed in Quetta, was not on a war footing, as other mountain regiments might have been, who were stationed at Rasmak and Banu, further up the frontier. There were four batteries, each of four guns, four 3.7-inch howitzers, carried on eight mules. The officers were mounted, but by tradition, particularly in the battery that I was in, one was expected to walk, march, and only ride a horse when it was absolutely necessary. The mule marched at 4 miles in the hour, therefore a mountain battery speed was considerably higher than ordinary marching infantry. The first thing that happened to me was I was allocated a munchie, an elderly man whose job it was to teach me Urdu. I found that although many of the other ranks spoke English, it was generally accepted that they did not address you in English, and you were expected to learn Urdu as quickly as possible, and the customs of the Sikhs and the Mohammedans, who were the soldiers of your battery.
Can I ask you whether there was a sort of taboo upon addressing you in English?
There was a taboo, but this was, as far as I can remember, and it's 44 years ago, this was waived during the first two or three months, or first 2 months of one service. The Viceroy commissioned officers addressed you in English and took you aside, and there was a lot of explaining to do. I mean, say, did not understand in the first instance that Mohammedans didn't drink, for instance, alcohol, and that Sikhs didn't smoke, and that they had entirely different religions and looks.
How did your soldiers react to you when you first met them? Did they grant you a sort of period of indulgence while you were learning the...
They granted us granted one a period of indulgence, that is absolutely true. And they treated one far more kindly than the British soldiers and British officers about the first field regiment I joined, who took a delight in seeing me fall off every horse in the regiment. But it was a quiet period. It was a period of leave. Half the battery was on leave. Most of the officers were on leave, somewhere or other, either in India or back to Europe. Therefore, there was not much. There was very little training going on, and that did not start until the spring, when one started with individual training, section training, battery training, and then regimental training. So one had arrived at the right time of the year and was broken in gently.
Now, you say that it was learning from scratch, again, that the system of mountain artillery was very different. What are the basic principles of mountain artillery work?
Well, mountain artillery work was based on frontier work. The support of a column of infantry who proceeded up or down a valley, occupying the surrounding heights on either side of the road, with a section of guns always with their trails on the ground, ready to give immediate support, either to the infantry taking the crest of a hill on the way up, or placing rounds on top of the hill to prevent the tribesmen shooting at the backs of the soldiers as they came down helter-skelter from the top of the hills. It was column work, and it had its own special tradition. There was a flag column commander called in his pickets. The gunners were ready to support those pickets as they came down, or as I say, if it was an advance, it was the other way about. This was the frontier, and we were training for frontier warfare. And of course, by the time we got to Africa, Kenya, we had to make a new set of rules for ourselves. A new set of rules which would cover artillery in bush and scrub land, where there were very few opportunities of vision. And certainly on the northern frontier of Kenya, it was very difficult.
Did you feel more at home once you got into Ethiopia?
Yes, I suppose so. Ethiopia was a gunner's dream because you always had an extremely good visibility. From your OPs, you could always see what you were shooting at. And whereas on the northern frontier, you couldn't. So many cases, one was shooting by sound rather than by vision.
When you were supporting a column of infantry going up a mountain valley, you say you always had to have a section with trails on the ground firing. Does that mean that the other half of the battery would be moving forward?
Leapfrogging.
What sort of range could your guns deliver?
With supercharge, which came in, I should think, about 1939, the maximum range was 6,500, and fairly accurate at that range. Normal range, one was shooting at 3,500 to 4,000.
So you would always be able to see your target. It would be direct observation.
What, on the frontier? Yes.
Yes.
On the frontier, yes. Generally.
Did you actually have forward observation officers on the frontier?
Yes, they would. They would go up with important pickets, but you must remember that I arrived in Quetta in November 1938, and we left on the 3rd of September 1939. Therefore, the practice, the actual physical practice of picket warfare, one had no experience. It was only in theory and on manoeuvres.
What about rate of fire? What rate of fire could you get?
It's a long time ago. gunfire, 6 rounds a minute, possibly. I can't say with accuracy now.
Did the gun have any particular strengths and weaknesses?
The 3.7-inch howitzer had no weaknesses whatsoever. It was all strength. It was the most beautiful piece of artillery. It was accurate. It was robust. And once you learned how to fire it, I mean, say, not the physical firing of the mechanism, but how to shoot it, you could shoot it with accuracy and safety. It was rather like a person who is good at shooting birds with a shotgun.
You mention in your script something about expecting that you might be sent to Turkey or somewhere of that sort. Would you like to say more about that, about these speculative ideas?
Yes, I think the speculation only lasted 3 days. And that was because John Darcy, our battery commander, had served in Turkey at the end of World War I in mountain artillery, if I remember rightly. We had such short notice of going to war that we couldn't really believe, we couldn't really understand where we were going to go. We knew that our horses and mules were taken away from us, and that some method of transport, whether it was mules and horses or motor transport, would be provided at the other end. And when Darcy sent for me and said, "Bulgy, we're going to war," and I asked him where, and he said, "I'm afraid I can't tell you until we embark, but we're going down to Karachi to embark and go overseas, but take your fishing rod, shotgun, a rifle, sporting rifle, and a dinner jacket." Well, now, that absolutely floored me. Where would I go in the world that required those four things? They all seemed very pleasant. We were obviously going to some strange place. And the nearest I could think of was somewhere like the Bosphorus or Constantinople. I never gave a thought to Nairobi in Kenya. And that is why I sort of speculated about Turkey.
So you hadn't really thought of Italy as a potential enemy?
No, I found it extremely, your question, rather searching. And looking back on it, I mean, say, during the Munich crisis, we dug slit trenches and filled sandbags at Bulford. But I didn't think we really understood that we were so near war. And from then until the 1st of September 1939... we were so busy. I was so busy in my new mountain artillery life and learning how to be a mountain gunner and support pickets up and down mountains that what happened in Europe was so far away that one didn't think. One should have done.
You mentioned, again, going on about the outbreak of war and mobilisation. It all had to happen in 3 days. And that you were a battery captain with all the duties on your shoulders. What were those duties? What did you have to do?
Well, the first thing that happened was this, that I was by no way, I was posted to the 22nd Mountain Battery from 23rd and the outbreak of war for this purpose. Although I'd been extremely friendly with John Darcy, and we'd gone fishing together and shooting expeditions, and this is probably possibly why he might have asked for me. But there were other reasons. Two of the regular captains in the regiment were away in Europe on leave. One was on leave in India, and that the time factor was all important. The senior subaltern had broken his arm show jumping 3 or 4 days beforehand, and the next senior to me was sent up to Lorelei in disgrace for some youthful prank, and he'd be sent to an outstation, and there was nobody else. And there, by mistake, Leach was posted, and I was told that I would be a captain. And the thought of promotion was so far away. I'd gone on a YO's course in 1936, and it was only 1939, and there were people about with First World War medals. So there it was. And I said to John Darcy, when he told me that I was going as battery captain, "Well, my goodness, I don't know the first thing about it." "Oh," he said, "you'll find out. All you have to do is keep your head screwed on. And it'll all come right." And I'm glad to say that it did come right. One had all one's stores taken away from them, except for the guns and the dial sights and the optical instruments. And when we got to Karachi, there was 6 months, 3 months' supply of stores. Everything that we could want had been exchanged wherever possible. And 6 months' supply of medical stores. It really was quite a feat of efficiency. I don't know how the Indian command, high command, had arranged it. All delivered. There it was waiting for us beside the quay, or on the quay beside the sea in Karachi. And I just took over the stores, mounds and mounds of forms to sign. There was no time to check them. We only had that night. But when we got to Nairobi, and I had to help the East African Service Corps, Ordnance Corps, set up an artillery depot, it was then that one began to learn the hard way, because so many of these things the East African Command had not seen, so many of the specialised parts for the guns, specialised equipment that we used in a mountain battery. And they had to be unpacked, they had to be put on shelves, they had to be numbered, and I was given a building in Nairobi, which became a sort of artillery depot in miniature. And the unpacking and the sorting of these things helped me to learn my job.
Did you get any assistance in doing this organisation work?
Yes, we had a great deal of assistance. The East African Force Headquarters were very helpful. I had all the backup that one needed, people to make shelves, people to help me sort, fetch and carry, as well as one's own quartermaster, Havildar, and his henchmen belonging to the battery. I was given a car and a beautiful Fanny driver who took me hither and thither.
Who did you rely on most for advice when you were in a quandary, when you were sorting out these stores?
My battery commander, John Darcy. He was always there to advise and help. Very knowledgeable, extremely knowledgeable man.
So in effect, until you got on the boat, your work of mobilisation consisted of taking the stores over, getting them loaded, signing for them.
That's right.
And then the real work began at the other end.
Yes.
How long did it take you to get it all sorted out and racked up?
I would think it took about over a period of 3 months. By Christmas, everything was settled. We had all we'd sorted out what we wanted. We had indented back to India for what we thought we might need over and above what they'd given us, and we were busily making sure that a similar amount of stores were made available for the East African Light Battery who were already with us.
Were they a new formation?
They were absolutely fresh off the trees. McKinley, Major McKinley, who commanded the first East African Light Battery, was an experienced settler, and I think he must have had military training. The battery captain and the two subalterns had very little training. And the men were just ordinary Keno settlers, a very fine type of gentleman. No bother to train because they were intelligent. And once they were trained, they took over the training of their African soldiers.
How long did it take you to indoctrinate them with gunnery?
Again, I would think 3 months. And that East African Light Battery left East Africa and saw service in Somaliland, and a great deal of service in Somaliland. And I believe they had to leave all their equipment behind, if I'm not mistaken, when they were evacuated from...
Berbera,
that's right.
What sort of guns did they have?
They had exactly the same as ourselves, you see. 3.7-inch howitzers, carried in the same type of vehicle made by the Kenya and Uganda railway workshops.
You mentioned these vehicles. What were their characteristics?
They were 3-ton vehicles with flat back or open back, and the gun was run up on ramps, steel ramps, two steel ramps which were carried one either side of the vehicle in slots, quick release slots. Slots from which they could be released quickly. And the gun was run up facing backwards and was clamped to the floor of the lorry. And there was so much ammunition with the lorry, and then a similar vehicle would follow as the ammunition lorry.
Were you able to fire from the back of the vehicle?
No, we could not fire from the back of the vehicle. The guns had to be released and run down. That only a moment, but a question of seconds.
I think you also mentioned that you had to train your drivers to use motor transport. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I'm afraid that question has floored me. I thought of it even before you asked it. But we must have done, and I think we must have taken it in turns, to take people and drive them across the Imbagathi plains, well away from the road, until they got to learn to be proficient in with their motor vehicles, which they quickly became. And when you think of it, they had to drive in convoy one way or another 2,000 miles up north before we came out at Asmara, Massawa. They had a lot of practice, and there was not much oncoming traffic.
When you were travelling in convoy, what sort of interval did you have between vehicles?
I've forgotten all my staff cottage figures, how many VTM and MIH and what have you. But I think that the overriding factor was the dust, particularly in the Ogaden before we got into the highlands of Ethiopia, Abyssinia. You kept your dust distance. Otherwise, it was impossible to travel.
What sort of speed could you maintain?
As low as 10 miles in the hour, at times, on those camel tracks. But of course, when we got onto those excellent roads built by the Italians and they were in Abyssinia, the speed was greater till we got into the mountain sections. Such a pity that the Italians were made to give up Abyssinia, because in the years that they'd been there, they'd done a tremendous lot of remarkable engineering works, roads, farms, irrigation.
Did you have any sort of system for signalling up and down a column when it was on the move?
Uh, No, I can't even remember whether the motorcyclists. I think that the two British or Kenyan artificers had motorcycles. There would, of course, be radio, which we received when we got to Africa. But these two Tiffies looked after the transport extremely well, and I don't think we ever either had an accident or had to leave a vehicle behind. The only vehicle that I have left behind was my own staff car when I was travelling from Addis up towards Gondar, when we had a series of blowouts through faulty tubes. That wasn't mechanical. That was physical more than anything else.
You mentioned radios. What other means of signalling did you have?
We had every means of signalling. We had heliographs. Have you ever tried to set up a helio? I did it. I had to do it because I was going on a signals course in Pune. Instead, I went to Africa to war. But I can't say that I could do it now. We had helio. We had flags. And we had a device which I think must have come from General Leto Forbeck, a sort of shutter which you put up on a pole, and it had red and white, and you flash Morse code at it. And then at one stage in the proceedings, so that one could get better observation, they provided me with a huge metal ladder with stays, and I was supposed to climb up that and sit on top of it and direct the fire of the guns. I only did it once, and every Italian in the neighbourhood shot at me, and I made sure that the thing was lost and was never seen again. It was far too dangerous. I mean, it's just sitting up there in a sort of bucket seat. Being shot at wasn't my idea of fun.
Were the radios you had reliable and effective?
By modern standards, no, but by the standards of those days, excellent.
What sort of range could you get out of them?
2 to 3 miles, but we always supplemented it with wire, the old traditional wire, the mill unreeling wire behind to the OP, unless we were in a very mobile type of warfare. Always laid wire whenever we could.
And you're also saying that in Kenya in particular, and in Somaliland, where it was flat and you couldn't get a vantage point for observation, you had to direct fire by sound rather than by sight. How did you go about doing that?
Well, if you had an FOO, or you were as battery commander with the forward troops, you brought your gunfire down on back to yourself. You made sure that the first shells were well over your head, and then brought them down, brought the range down to more or less where you wanted it.
Did you have any instruments for detecting sound?
No, you did it purely bow and arrow. There was nothing but there was nothing complicated about it. I'm afraid I'm a very bad mathematician. I never understood the trigonometries and the things which went on in the School of Artillery.
Just using your ear and then firing over your head.
That's right.
How many ranging shots did you normally need to get one on for that, that sort of method?